if a general practitioner has a scope of practice that includes and always will include things that specialists do as well, they should be paid the same.
Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell. That was Professor Jennifer May, who is Director of the University of Newcastle's Department of Rural Health, based in Tamworth. Jenny is a co-author of new research published in the MJA, showing an alarming decline in the number of medical graduates registering as general practitioners. The reasons are many, including the lack of financial incentives for GPs, but also including the education and training of our medical students. Jenny is joined today by the paper's lead author, Denise Playford, who is an associate professor in the University of WA's Rural Clinical School. Jenny and Denise are my special guests today. We know that the number of GPs is falling. Why did you feel you had to do this research? What was missing from the data set?
Well, the problem was that a lot of the knowing about GP falling is anecdotal. So we wanted to actually look at the number of people who were entering the GP workforce after graduation.
Yep.
And that data just wasn't out there, despite everybody confidently asserting it.
So how did you... Tell us a little bit about the design of the study. How did you go about collecting the data?
So Ian Putty, Professor Ian Putty, has been looking at the outcomes of the medical school at UWA in particular since the 80s. And we have been tracking them using ARPRA because ARPRA is an unbiased estimate of location.
Right.
We cannot necessarily find all graduates on ARPRA, but the ones who are missing we know are no different from the ones that we find in terms of their demographics and all of their personal information.
Uh-huh.
So we've been tracking them, all medical graduates from UWA since 2014. And that's a very rich data set of information.
So presumably it tells you all the specialties they're going into and how and when they're registering. What did you find about GP graduates?
Ian Putty's been looking at the college that the graduates eventually become listed with since 2016.
Yeah.
So he's been keeping all college data for nearly 5 years. When he passed the data on to me and I graphed it, it was just incredible.
Mm.
You'll notice that on our graph, we finish at 2007. If you continue to the graph on, it would be even more striking. But the bottom line is that there's a twofold decrease in the number of GPs who go into GP colleges after graduation.
Wow.
For 2004 to 7 versus 1985 to 87. So it's a radical drop.
Yes.
From around 40% to less than 15%.
Is there any reason to think that trend has changed in the 10 years since?
Well, I have to say that we're agnostic because we're tied to the data.
Yes.
But what we do show, what is very clear, even in the data that's presented in the article, is that the number of generally registered only practitioners strikingly increases after the year 2000.
Yes, yes.
Now, so there is every suggestive evidence that indeed the GP is going to continue going down.
Explain to me what a generally registered practitioner can do and in what setting.
All qualified doctors can have general registration, so they register. They're entered on ARPRA as being generally registered.
Yep.
So after graduation, that's the status of any medical graduate
who's
gone through an AMC approved course, which recognises them as a doctor. So they can practice. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the hospital system, there are numbers of generally registered practitioners, and if you don't choose to go on to a college, of which there are a small number, as you'll see in the table from the year dot, then you can continue practicing in the hospital as generally registered practitioner.
Do we know why those numbers have increased?
Well, our hypothesis is that as the GP numbers are going down, that doesn't mean that people are disinterested in college specialty.
Mm.
It suggests rather that they're interested in other college specialties.
Yes, it does.
And for other colleges, there's actually a fair bit of competition. For GP, it's a really wide open market because GPs are needed in some areas like rural, and there's never enough of them. But for other specialties, internal medicine is a prime example. you'll see the increase in interest on the graph, that there are limited numbers of training positions. People who want to go for them are going to stay generally registered until such time as they get accepted into a training position.
Whereas if they wanted to be GPs, they could walk into the training program tomorrow, presumably.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. So given that you're tied to the data, do you have any hypotheses about why this decline is happening?
Well, I think we all know about the erosion of trust in GP as a profession, the issues with reimbursement from Medicare, Medicare freezes, the fact that GP is not taught as one of the big key disciplines in medical schools, that the other disciplines actually have quite a high priority compared to their actual composition in the workforce.
Yeah. So
there's numbers of factors, status, payment and opportunity as well.
I would also say there's been a loss of interest in generalism.
Yeah.
And that's not something that's just related to medicine and healthcare. But I think that's a societal change that we are now much more interested in people subspecialising in small areas of expertise as opposed to having a generalist holistic approach. So I think what we're seeing in medicine in particular is being echoed both in within medical specialties. So within medical specialties, generalism is not particularly attractive to trainees, and it's not well thought of by those in who run our medical schools and who run our acute hospitals. But also, it's just as obvious, for instance, in veterinary medicine and in legal practice, accountancy, those sorts of things.
Jenny, what does this decline do specifically in rural settings? How does it make it more difficult?
This is hugely challenging in rural settings because rural settings, if you like, are the canary in the coal mine.
So the
loss of general practitioners and general practice has become evident earlier than it would likely to become evident metropolitan. So the sorts of things that we see are obviously gaps in service delivery and a loss of a breadth of care being provided locally. So the flow-on effects of that are things like more patients being transferred out of rural areas for treatment that would have previously been provided by a well-credentialed local practitioner.
Yes.
And also a consumer expectation that generalism is not the best option. So just as general practitioners become less available, the system becomes less efficient and the consumers start to see that a metropolitan provided service is of somehow higher quality. I think the other things that we have noticed is that the loss of those generalism skills and general practice in rural areas has really impacted and what we're seeing as substitution is fly-in, fly-out models that often don't have that community connection and that holistic whole person care that we have previously associated with general practice.
It must make the whole system more expensive too, surely.
If not
for the consumer, then for the
and more
system.
Expensive.
Yeah.
And potentially some of the barriers that are now in place in terms of accreditation, et cetera, are also making it very much financially less attractive for rural practitioners to keep, for instance, capacity for obstetrics, surgery and emergency, where they might find themselves having CPD requirements in three different domains.
Yes.
And rather than having their generalism celebrated, it becomes a financial and logistic barrier.
I mean, obviously the elephant in the room at the moment is COVID-19. Can you see any flow-on effects into this situation from the situation we find ourselves in now? It's sort of a question that has to be asked at this point.
It is too early to tell, Kate, and
yeah,
I think that's the honest answer.
Mm.
I think if, as a rural GP and a previous rural generalist, my concern is that you could feel more isolated as a rural GP to the future managing COVID unless there were specific supports and you were part of a supportive network that encouraged you to work to your scope where you were. And I guess the concern is that in rural we have lower critical mass. So if our workforce does become sick and is unable to practice to that full scope, then the impacts on the community are significant. And we are all members of our communities and feel a responsibility to deliver. So if I, that's a risk, I guess, that COVID presents a greater isolating force that we hadn't had previously.
And I think the other thing is that it's really clear from the data that COVID affects older people more than younger people in terms of both morbidity and mortality. And we know that the rural GP workforce tends to be older than the urban GP workforce.
Yes.
And yet they are the frontline carers, particularly in really small communities where there's solo GPs. The younger incoming GPs tend not to go to solo practices as much as group practices. So I guess there will be a flow-on effect if there is, in fact, a bulge of cases still coming.
I'm chatting today with Associate Professor Denise Playford from UWA and Professor Jennifer May from the University of Newcastle about the decline of general practice and how we can halt it. Their co-authored research is available at mja.com.au, where it is, of course, open access. The MJA now has a dedicated COVID-19 webpage, where you will find all our COVID articles, all open access. Visit mja.com.au/journal/COVID-19. Back to our chat. Let's talk about the status of general practitioner training in medical schools. You're both medical educators. How do we change the emphasis? How do we get GP more emphasis during medical school? Because that seems to be where the rot starts to set in.
I have to say that as soon as I saw this data, I brought it back to my colleagues. So I'm with the rural clinical school and all my colleagues are remote. But we have independence from the urban program in the sense of how we teach and how we assess. So I took it back to a group and we have now completely reinvigorated our GP curriculum to make it really dynamic, really case-based and very broad in scope. As Jennifer just said, the GP, rural GP is very broad in scope.
Fantastic.
So we're hoping that that will enthuse RCS graduates to understand the interest and the vitality of rural GP.
What do you think, Jenny?
Kate, I think it's a huge issue. The current medical curriculum supports a very discipline-specific specialist approach. And that is both in the sort of graduate learning outcomes, but also it's easier to teach volumes of students in hospitals where patients are aggregated. And general practice is very much a cottage industry still and very dispersed. So you can see that the, in terms of the ease of access both to clinical material and to teachers, hospitals are going to win out. I think we must look at academic general practice and look at supporting academic general practice. And if you think about it, in most medical schools, you'll have a professor of O&G, you'll have a professor of internal medicine, you'll have a professor of paediatrics and a professor of this and a professor of that, and you'll have a professor of general practice. So that's one versus many. Now, that is the message that we are giving our students, and I understand why it's happened, but I do think that some attention to supporting the status of generalism and affirming activities that work towards a broad scope of practice as opposed to a narrow scope of practice, will serve us well.
Has the number of working GPs who are willing to supervise registrars, has that changed?
I don't think that that is a rate-limiting step. So at the moment, GPs who supervise medical students in general practice are eligible for a PIP payment of $200 a session, and I think the availability of that payment has certainly held many of our general practitioners in the game because they are able to reduce the numbers of patients they see and still hang in the game. But I think the economic viability of general practice has reduced over time. And as a consequence, I don't think it is fair to expect that the teaching load and an increased teaching load is not put into general practice without specific financial and academic support.
Jenny, I really agree, because the PIP plate payment is actually quite a small token gesture towards teaching. Mm. But if you have cut your patient load by 10%, your income will be affected. And in the hospital setting, it's not affected at all because, as you said, the patients are there anyway.
Yes.
So the students learn opportunistically from a very wide range of patients. And of course, GPs also have to equip their practices with another practice room for mm-hmm. students if they're going to practice independently. Not all GPs have that facility. So I think there are a lot of other issues in terms of teaching GP, which I might add is actually a better teaching experience for undergraduate medical students, because GPs work, as Jennifer said, in a generalist paradigm,
yes,
which is actually the vision of medical education at an undergraduate level. So it's been pushed to the side, even though its vision is actually totally central.
Yeah, as opposed to versus hospital training, which is a whole
yes.
other kettle of fish. Yeah.
Which should be a minority of specialties, but not the sole picture.
Yeah. I think the other problem we've got is the first couple of years, PGY 1 and 2,
mm-hmm.
and again, similar to the medical student issue, the number of mentors and those that students can model themselves and their future careers on is very limited in PGY 1 and 2. So the lack of exposure in those formative PGY 1 and 2 years to general practice, I think, has also contributed to the current state of play. Now, we all mourn a program called PGPPP,
yeah.
which was about 10 years ago, where residents were able to rotate through general practice environments. And that was an opportunity to expose that PGY 1 and 2 workforce to very positive role models
mm-hmm.
of general practice, and an opportunity to try before you buy.
Yes.
And that's, let's face it, an opportunity that those PGY 1 and 2s get in hospital to try before they buy a number of different specialties.
But not
GP. So I think the loss of that exposure in PGY 1 and 2 is another reason why I think that this decline will increase unless we absolutely start to drill down on the many facets of why it is so. I do believe that it's fulfilled a really important need.
Mm.
And I think there have been attempts to refloat that program, certainly in rural areas, with the Rural Junior Doctor Innovation Fund program. So I think that demonstrates that the Commonwealth is aware that there were very valuable outcomes from that program.
Mm.
But unless it is scaled and generalised so that many, many of our resident doctors can undertake that, I think it is a boutique offering for the very few, and I think it will not have outcomes commensurate with what the outcomes that we need.
I think in terms of the recent hub funding that's been allocated for postgraduate training in rural areas associated with rural clinical schools,
mm-hmm.
I think the focus of that hub funding has done the same thing as medical school focus. So it's a very specialised, it's real focus is on how many rural specialists it's going to recruit.
Yeah.
And I guess we just need to keep on banging the drum to say GP has to be the first port of call, which then directs people to the second port of call.
Yes.
Not saying that either is more important, but just say that one is primary in time and primary in terms of numbers. And so, yeah, the hub funding might turn down the same path if we're not careful.
Denise, if you could wave a magic wand, money no object, queen for a day, what would you do right now?
I would shape a new postgraduate training pathway that has very clear and very well-financed options for training GPs in the broadest general sense. I would make sure that all general practices have rooms for graduates and students to work together
mm-hmm.
Outside of the GP consulting room. And I would ensure that Medicare and all of the reimbursements for GP are actually commensurate with the specialist colleges.
Jenny? Money's no object. Go for
it. Oh, absolutely. I was going to say I would. My wand waving would involve equal pay for equal work.
Yep.
And if a general practitioner has a scope of practice that includes and always will include things that specialists do as well, they should be paid the same. So I don't believe that an internal medicine consultation of 15 minutes should be worth three times a general practitioner consult. You know, there is a process of clinical reasoning and management that we teach all medical students, and I don't quite see that the relative value of those activities is so disparate. So that's number one. The second thing is that I think as a society and as a country, we actually need to understand why we have the health outcomes we have. From my point of view, when I know that access to health services is 30% of our health outcome, and much of else of it is both our genetics and our risk factors and how we manage those, I would suggest to you that promoting prevention and whole person care is as important as the latest machine that goes bip. Now, I absolutely accept, and in the time of COVID, I am absolutely hoping that as many people have the best ventilators in my area, so that if I need one of those, that it is available to me with a fully trained ICU clinician standing beside it. So I absolutely celebrate subspecialty capacity and subspecialty expertise. Yes. And that cannot be gained in 5 minutes. But what I also think we need to celebrate is the generalist, preventive, whole person, holistic approach. Yep. That says a consultation in general practice that may involve mental health and psychiatry, that may involve cardiovascular outcomes, and that may involve domestic violence, is seen by both society and our medical peers of considerable value. And I think if we move towards a model where general practice as a gatekeeper into secondary care and as a deliverer of a majority and a series of really important and effective health services, if we manage that, then I think we will change the game for graduating students and residents, and it will become something that people want to do. When I hear people talk about GPs, they talk in disparaging terms about GPs, and then they say, but I've got a good one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I go, excuse me, so if you've got a good one, why aren't you advocating to make sure that they are valued within the system and within society is supported and maintained?
Yeah.
Because you've recognised on a personal level that that's important. Yeah. And only 15% of people should be referred out of general practice. General practice, you know, with a wide scope, should be able to manage 85% of undifferentiated problems that come its way.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it so interesting.
Yeah.
At core, it really is a very interesting discipline.
I'm very hopeful that the National Medical Workforce Strategy will pick up some of the themes that we've been talking about, because I think that this is the major dilemma that is facing medicine in general, that we are not training people fit for purpose for what is community need. And we, you know, by hook or crook, have ended up in a situation where we are training very high-quality specialists. We have a very high-quality specialist workforce, but we have a diminishing interest in a high-quality general practice workforce. Yeah. And if only 15% of our medical graduates are interested in a career in general practice, then that will really challenge the model, the gatekeeper holistic model of general practice that we've grown up with and whose health outcomes we have expected will continue.
And we know that that model is gold standard in terms of the work, the whole comparison with the world data on best outcomes. So GP countries that have a strong primary care GP workforce have the best health outcomes, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yes. It's
been clearly shown by many authors. And I guess the other thing is that our data, what we found really interesting, Jennifer May and I, when we were looking at our data, is that it matches exactly the medical school's outcomes database student data for 2019, which said that only 15% of graduates are thinking about GP, which matches our 15% outcome. We have a 15% in the end actual number who go into GP. So it's genuine. It's not speculation here. We're talking about reality.
Thank you both for your time. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.